As most of our listeners know, recently the Cook County Board of Commissioners voted to keep two proposed MnDOT towers under the magic number of 200 feet so that they would not have to be lighted during the day or at night. As we all maybe take too much for granted, but know that Cook County is one of the darkest locations in the lower 48 states, and lots of people want to keep it that way. Here to explain the benefits of a dark sky and what is being done to preserve it is John Barentine, a program manager at the International Dark Sky Association. John, welcome to the Roadhouse.
Thanks for having me, Buck. Appreciate it.
Well, first of all, let's kind of look at the big picture here, if you will. What is the International Dark Sky Association?
We are a nonprofit organization based in Arizona, but our activities are truly worldwide, and our mission is to preserve and protect the nighttime environment and our heritage of dark skies through environmentally responsible lighting.
And you name yourself the International Dark Sky Association. Explain the international connection.
Well, we have a membership of about 3,000 people that are distributed all over the world. They're mostly based in the United States and Europe, but we do have a presence on pretty much every other continent. The main thing I would have your listeners understand is that we are not the light cops. Our
right.
intent is not to come in and just shut off all the lights, because we don't think that that is a viable solution to the problem. But rather, our intent is to help people all over the world make better choices about the light that they do use.
I want to get into a little bit more of that later on after we get the big picture look here. Let's talk a little bit about systems for measuring what is and is not a dark sky, or what is the continuum of dark sky to bright sky. How do you do that?
Well, we have a couple of approaches to that. One is a subjective way of sort of addressing the situation, and that is simply how many stars can you see? On a given night, depending on where you're at in the world and the amount of light pollution that's around you, the answer to that could be anywhere from literally a handful to perhaps many thousands of them. And whether or not you can see the stars is an indication of how clear your sky is. And in clearness, I include the presence of light that kind of acts as a fog that gets between us and the light of the stars. We also have some electronic means of measuring the brightness of the night sky, everything from little individual light meters up to more sophisticated systems that use very highly calibrated cameras to do that. So we have been able to scientifically study the issue of light pollution, and that's providing some input into the ways that we approach addressing the problem.
I was reading about something called the Bortle scale. Are you familiar with that, and how does that apply?
Yeah. The Bortle scale is one of these subjective means of kind of assessing the quality of a night sky, and it has you look for particular things in the sky, so you need to have a little bit of background knowledge, finding constellations, stars, that sort of a thing. But it's a very intuitive scale that runs from 1 to 9, so in a completely dark place, it's free of all light pollution. We would call that a 1 on that scale. And if you were in a big city, if you were in downtown, you know, Times Square, New York, you would probably be towards the end of the 9 part of the scale.
Mm-hmm. What about around the world? What are some of the obvious most dark skies? Areas, I should
say. You have to get away from the big population centers. That's one thing. So, of course, you're going to be far away from the cities. But it also depends on which cities. In the United States and Europe and Japan, the problem is real serious because of how brightly we light our cities. And that's an indicator of the relative economic development of those parts of the world. We have a very high standard of living compared to some other parts of the world, and so it enables us to be effectively more wasteful with our light. there are vast parts of Central Asia, sub-Saharan Africa, the outback of Australia, for example, are places that you could go, and you would be hundreds of miles from any city of any consequence, and the smaller villages and towns that are near you are not nearly as dependent on electric light. So there are plenty of places in the world that are still dark, but only by virtue of the fact that electrification really hasn't reached there yet. Mm-hmm. So our challenge is both to address the problem in the Western world, where we have so much light that we can afford to waste it, but also to prevent that mentality from sort of taking hold in the less developed parts of the world.
Well, looking at a map of the U.S., you know, there's hardly any place that doesn't have roads and towns and cities in it, but there are certainly large areas of the West and maybe the North where you must have fairly decent dark skies.
Certainly. Out here in the West, there are a lot of places. In part, it's just because our population density is so low. Mm-hmm. We have big cities out here, but we don't have the concentration of cities and inhabited areas as they do in the eastern half of the country. But you look at a map of the U.S. at night, and you know, even up in Minnesota, there are vast areas of northern Minnesota, in particular, that are wildlife areas that are still very dark at night for being in the lower 48 states. So the good news is that your listeners still have access to this resource in places that are not terribly far away from where they live. And, of course, now the challenge is how do we keep it that way?
Exactly. So keeping it that way, what are the primary justifications for wanting to keep the skies dark?
There are a variety of reasons that I would give people as to why we should keep the sky dark, and they appeal to all different kinds of people because some will react more strongly to others. One good reason is that the amount of light pollution that we emit here in the United States represents an enormous waste of our resources in terms of the energy that we produce and the money that is required to produce it. And the method that we use to produce most of our energy is still based on fossil fuels. So for as much light pollution as we're emitting, that means we're also putting that much more carbon into our atmosphere, and that's beginning to have an impact on our climate and our long-term weather patterns. I have done some calculations that suggest that the waste in dollars in a typical year in the United States is anywhere between about $1.5 billion to as much as maybe $4 billion. And that's not in the light that's useful to us. It's on the ground. That's just the light that's literally escaping up into the sky. So you're looking at somewhere between about $5 and $15 for every man, woman, and child in the United States, which adds up to a really enormous amount of money. We know that there are impacts to wildlife caused by light pollution. There are some animals that are especially sensitive to it, but the research suggests that basically every kind of creature at some level is sensitive because they came up in a world where there was no artificial light. And if people don't respond to the energy argument and they're, you know, they say, well, I'm not really concerned about the animals, then I would say that maybe the most immediate effect on us is that we're beginning to understand that light pollution has an impact on human health. The research has implicated it in the incidence of various kinds of chronic disease up to and including cancer.
And I suppose the disruption of circadian rhythms and sleep patterns and that sort of thing, too.
Absolutely. There's studies showing that, you know, America is losing a certain fraction of its productivity simply to the fact that its workers are sleep-deprived. And there's certainly connections to public safety in terms of people being asleep at the wheel, that kind of a thing. And it's not just the light that is outside and goes up into the sky, but now we're talking about the light that we're exposed to indoors, and especially in that last hour or two before we go to sleep, thinking of the number of people who are staring at screens of computers and cell phones and tablets well into the late hours, and the light that those screens is emitting is very blue in color relative to other sources of light that are inside at night. And speaking of circadian disruption, that blue light is very in tune with the circadian system of the body, and it is actually tricking the body into believing that it's still daylight outside. And that's then causing this cascade of chemicals in the body that has been at least tentatively linked to incidents of disease.
Well, to our listeners who just joined us, we're speaking with John Barentine, program manager at the International Dark Sky Association. We're talking about preserving and the wisdom of preserving dark skies where they still are dark. And you mentioned driving at night, and how do you respond to critics who say that, you know, we need that, we need light, we need street lights for security, and we need parking lot lights for security, and so on?
Sure. There are fundamentally two issues involved in that. One is safety, in the sense of safety for pedestrians and motorists, and then there's the issue of security, on the other hand, which is about deterring crime. Mm-hmm. The safety part, we would absolutely agree that there are definitely circumstances where we need outdoor light in environments at night in order to assure public safety, and those are generally in what we call conflict zones, which any time where you have traffic coming together, like at an intersection, or, you know, traffic lanes merging, or places where you have high traffic in bicycles, pedestrians crossing the road, et cetera, you definitely need light in order to see those moving targets. But when you're away from those areas where you don't expect there to be people crossing the roads, I'm thinking more highways, that sort of thing, it turns out that your headlights are much more efficient in helping you see potential hazards than continuous overhead lighting is. Mm-hmm. So we're advocating that in some cases, especially once you're away from the really dense urban cores and cities, that adding overhead light like we have been doing for so many decades may actually be causing more problems than it is solving. And on the issue of the security, this has been studied academically, and the evidence isn't conclusive, but it's strongly suggestive that putting a lot of light into our outdoor environments at night is not only not reducing crime, but it may actually be encouraging crime. And the analogy that I use is, you go to the grocery store in the evening, or you go to another business, and I'm even guilty of this. I pull into a parking lot, and my instinct tells me, park under a light, you'll be safer. But then I think about it again, and sort of the rational side of my mind says, well, if I park under a light, all I'm going to do is light up the inside of my car and show a thief what potentially I have in there to steal, or how easy it might be to steal my car itself. Sure. And that applies generally in the sense that whereas we think we're deterring people from doing bad things, we may actually be helping them to be able to do bad things by using so much light.
Well, I know folks that are listening here want me to ask you some questions about communication towers. We've had that issue come up here, and I mentioned it in my intro that if you keep the communication towers under 200 feet, they don't have to be lighted during either the day or the night, is my understanding. And the question is really, I mean, on a communication tower that's over 200 feet, that's got a red light at night and a strobe light, or whatever strobe light, I guess I'll call it, in the daytime, is that bad? I mean, you'd think that wouldn't make much of a difference, having that one light on. Is that, do we lose points on the Bortle scale for having that?
Well, it's a combination of things. Every bit of light that we put into the outdoor environment at night has an impact on it. The lights on a communication tower might not be numerous enough or bright enough to have an impact on the darkness of your night sky. It's not zero, but it may be minimal. But, of course, you have to consider where some of these structures may be placed and where they're located with respect to areas that are ecologically sensitive. And if you put a light like that up on a very tall pole or a mast, the distance away from that pole that you can see that light is much greater than if it is near the ground. So while there may not be much light on each individual tower, the land area around the tower from which that light can be seen is very large. And so it has this impact over a much larger area than you would have if you think of lower things like light poles or your typical utility poles that are much closer to the ground.
And I am sure what you were referring to a moment ago was the areas where you put them make a difference. And if you put it in an area that is almost totally dark already, and you add that light, it has a much bigger impact, obviously, than if you put it in the middle of a city.
Correct. You have to think about what the ambient level of light is. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, we have come to tolerate a level of ambient light that is much higher than it ever was in the past. And certainly, going back to the era before there was electric light at all, when our spaces were routinely dark. And now we live in an era when your typical parking lot, for example, is lit about anywhere between about 5 to 10 times more brightly than they were roughly 25 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And another example where people are going to be very familiar with is you pull into a gas station at night and you pull under the canopy by the gas pumps and they have that area lit up very brightly. In many cases, the canopies over gas pumps are now lit to levels that are either comparable to or even brighter than the same light levels that are recommended for indoor office work. So we've literally brought the indoors outside, and of course there are consequences, because if you're filling up your car under that bright light, then you get in, head back out onto a dark street, you're momentarily blinded because your eyes haven't had enough time to respond to being in dark conditions. And that in and of itself creates a public safety concern.
The other thing I think we missed when I was asking you about the different benefits of dark skies was the idea of sort of being able to have a connection with the natural world and the Milky Way and the galaxy and that sort of thing. That's a healthy thing.
I'd agree with you entirely, and we are not so distantly removed from the time in human history when what you're describing was an experience that everyone on Earth had access to before there was internet and before there was TV and before there was radio. If you go back into history, at the end of the night, there was nothing to do but look up. And a lot of our history is bound up in the night sky. It's been a source of inspiration for art and literature, even the figures of the constellations. Anybody who's ever looked at a sky map and looked at all the mythology of the constellations, it's very evident that that used to be something that inspired people to tell stories. And a lot of our residents in America now, at least, are rather disconnected from that. So I would agree. I think that at the end of the day, we need certain spaces that are sort of off limits from the day in, day out hectic pace of life that most of us lead. And we need some respite from that. And that includes exposure to all of this light at night.
And before we wind up here, can you talk a little bit about what can communities or local governments or individuals do to improve the darkness of the sky?
Every act counts. That's what I like to tell people. Even the smallest effort counts to help toward protecting the night sky. Individuals, I would say, can look at their own property, their own places where they live, look for opportunities to improve the lighting, ask yourself, is a light necessary in the first place? If it is it the right amount of light for the task? Is it properly shielded to make sure that none of the light that the fixture is emitting is going up into the sky? There's a lot of information now available out there for people to make good choices about their lighting. The packaging on lighting that you would buy at a typical home improvement store has a lot of useful information on it for people to make really well-informed decisions. And I would say also that they should demand action from their elected officials. And mostly that involves cities and towns putting in place lighting ordinances that help put some legal restrictions on how light can be used. We're now in a period of time when we're seeing a conversion from old lighting technologies over to the LED that people are beginning to see more commonly in outdoor spaces, and a lot of cities are doing that because it's more energy efficient and it will save them on their electric bills, but we're concerned that there are some issues with the LEDs that may actually make our situation with light pollution worse. So the more people know, the more they're able to go and ask their elected officials to do the right thing. But again, everything that people do toward solving this problem helps.
Well, that's a very interesting and helpful response. And I want, because I've looked at it and know you have a wonderful website, I want to make sure we refer people to that. And it, correct me if I'm wrong, but darksky.org.
That's correct.
Is your website.
We have a lot of useful information up there for people about the problem of light pollution, its effects on people and the environment, and ways that people can help.
Is there anything else you'd like to add before we leave the topic?
All I would say is that I think the problem is easy for us to understand and it's easy for us to solve. The challenge is just simply raising awareness of the issue and bringing it to a personal level for people, which will get them to care about it. If we can get people to care, I think this is a problem we can solve and we can win.
Well, John Barentine, Program Manager of the International Dark Sky Association, thank you so much for sharing your time and your knowledge on this very interesting subject and very topical for us right now. Thank you.
Thanks. It's been a delight. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.